Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. And you.
Makalua.
The me and team.
QNL.
Welcome to Season 6. I'm Dan Q. On behalf of myself and my fellow regular panelists, Makalua, the mean team at QNL, we present to you the following to start the second year of our live broadcast format. Several archive segments of full topic discussions recorded for episodes last year that were cut due to runtime in post-production. Our first episode recording for 2012 is set for January 14th at 12 p.m. Eastern, North America, at thepolycast.net. Enjoy, and remember, keep on sipping. Recorded for episode 122.
Open border for 50 gold. Well, personally, I'm not very conservative when it comes to my borders. It takes me a while before I start letting people in, before I start opening. I would think that maybe if they sweeten the deal a little bit, give me something to, like, as they say, wet my beak, I might be more inclined to open it up for them.
Can't you sell open borders right now anyway?
Well, you can trade, you can, I guess you can say, open my borders, give me 50 gold.
Do what Dan did to a person in multiplayer who doesn't even realize it just gave him gold for open borders.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
And you gotta pay attention to those deals.
Yeah, you're getting a vassal to me.
Yeah, the selling open borders for 50 gold, of course, that's assuming they have a friendly disposition towards you. Otherwise, you're going to get significantly less than that. Even if it still says friendly, you can kind of get a gleaning towards that perhaps they're not as friendly as they used to be. Because I found that giving them open borders, so you give open borders to them for 50 gold, they're not giving you open borders in return. It's what you're getting is the gold, which was not a possibility in Civilization 4. And found that at times the 50 gold, even when they're friendly, can go down to like 43. Any of the numbers might vary slightly what you can get out of it. But what a way to get yourself some gold further on in the game. Especially trying to do that the farther away the civilization is. Then they really don't seem to take that much advantage to open borders anyway, right? It doesn't seem to be like even if they're right beside you that as soon as there's that, all of a sudden they're really scouting out your territory, and maybe I'd be less inclined to do that if I realized no more about my land, and then further from that, they would then actually modify their strategy, or that would actually be beneficial to them.
Yes, I would like to see some evidence that the AI logic actually implements its scouting information from your territory, because in Civ 4 there was none. And there is no downside to strategically to opening borders ever. You just take the trade route and run with it. I don't know how the Civ 5 AI functions, and I don't think too many people do beyond the developers in terms of that. But I have not heard anything about the AI using information it gleans from scouting one way or another in terms of declaring on you. Probably just checks your location and your power.
For me, I just hate opening my borders to the AI because I can't stand when they get their scouts trapped on the other side of my civilization.
It only happened on like one or two occasions where I sold open borders for 50 gold. And because of the one unit per tile, if they move on to a particular tile, say that you haven't quite improved yet, but you would like to, I've seen them sometimes sit there for turn after turn after turn. But hey, here's a good thing. In that rare situation, the fact that open borders automatically end, like all of your other freaking deals, means that they are gone, and it's no longer an issue. Hey, I found the bright side to that.
Hey, I don't have to declare war on them for not getting off of my lawn.
Recorded for episode 124.
From Zeknikov, he said, "What about thinking and artificial intelligence?" Makes a rather bold statement, controversial statement, I'm sure. I would rather play against cheating AI if it meant it was difficult instead of not cheating AI that made the game easy. If I truly want a challenge, I would play multiplayer. Unfortunately, the multiplayer in Civ 5 is terrible. There have been several threads about how does the artificial intelligence really compare to pre-patch. And of course, some people have, I think there's a valid argument here, have said it's kind of difficult to compare the AI to the previous patch because you're really not comparing the same game anymore. anymore with all of these changes. It's still the Civilization 5 on there, but has the AI really improved? And if you're going to measure that, is it really fair to measure that against what the game was before? I initially thought, man, the AI is better post-patch, but I think that's just maybe still am getting used to the game post-patch. I'm still catching up, as it were.
Maybe. I don't buy the, you can't compare the AI pre-patch to post-patch because it's slightly different strategy set. You know, they had a chance to rebalance because, well, they had all the code in front of them. So if the AI needed to learn something about the new mechanics, then they could have done that. You can't really say, oh, well, the old AI was good at its mechanics and the new AI is not good because it wasn't really that much of a change. They did change a lot of AI for strategies and policy choices and tech choices and that. The core statement in there was, if you want a challenge, play multiplayer. That's true. If it ever works, let us know and we'll get around to it. Because humans will always be gameplay AIs because the gaming industry just does not put the effort in to make it work. And it's because they just don't generally want to. The money's just not really there for it. So single-player games tend to be either, oops, here you go, you can mess around a little bit, or they put on a good multiplayer and say, ha, we don't have to worry about it. So, and that's really where it should have been. They should have, for Civ 5, definitely gone with multiplayer heavy on this one.
My long-standing problem with single-player AI in any turn-based strategy, really, not just Civ, but certainly rears its ugly head in Civ quite frequently, is you have, like, cheating beyond the bonus handicap that you're giving to the AI very frequently. And I don't really know the ins and outs, nuts and bolts of Civ 5 like I knew Civ 4, but I'm sure they're still doing it, where they're getting bonuses that you're not seeing when you pick the difficulty and then look in the XML tab to see the bonuses they're getting. They're certainly getting other things. But it's not that it doesn't play like a multiplayer human would, but so frequently a large chunk of the players in the game aren't playing the game then. And you have AIs that are essentially not trying, pretty much taking itself out of the game entirely, and at random boosting either the human player or one of the other players in the game in the process of doing so. And that's very frustrating because it's such a random chance thing. It has nothing to do with how well any of the Civs played except for the one that tanked itself to give somebody else the advantage.
Recorded for episode 127.
How far should you trust automation from Floki? Brangelosis never automate units? That's a very, very good idea. Civ 4 would often automate units once there wasn't any improvements that I at least could build or, you know, needed to build. And then I could have them, for instance, just aimlessly build roads by improving a trade network. And you definitely wouldn't want them to do that in Civ 5 because of the maintenance. I'd rather just have them sit in a city where I want them to, or actually just go ahead and delete those sinkers rather than have them on automate, because the added extra roads could be beneficial because it didn't cost you anything, and it could mean the difference between a turn or two of moving a unit from one city to another. But now that we don't have that, beyond a worker or even automating anything else, Omega Kabox is I only automate my second or third caravel. I don't trust anything else. Yeah, I wouldn't automate anything else.
I'll put it this way. I watch the AI make decisions, and I ask myself, do I want to make decisions for me? And I say, no.
Automate my general. You know what? There's some history of automation for the AI actually being superior to automation for the human. That wasn't the case in Civ 4. I can't say that I've tried automation enough in Civ 5 to see if that's true in Civ 5 also. But even if it's as good as the AI's automation, it definitely is
kind of a balance between how much you value your own time and the benefit that you get from microing your own workers. So it's kind of subjective, because some people have an unlimited amount of time to play the game, and so they are not going to automate ever, because they can control every single action of those workers. So there are less workers now, but they still can take a lot of time in the late game, and it becomes tempting to automate.
Yeah. Well, in late game, you're often divided one way or another. It's become clear that you're going to win or that you're not, in which case automation isn't going to hurt you too much. That's probably the only time I'd advocate it. And then watch what they do then. So you're going to build what they do. But it wouldn't surprise me if that isn't viable.
recorded for episode 129. The specific question that we have here is with regards to when someone should turn the slider to 100% culture in terms of going for a cultural victory, which is a good question for Civ 4. Maybe not general consensus, but from what I've seen is sometime a little bit after getting liberalism. Indeed, oftentimes also seeing people like to get democracy tech so they can run universal suffrage. Another thing that's very common, at least in Beyond the Sword, is people often want to research up to getting some of the cultural corporations because they add a lot of culture. If you can pick up things like Sid Sushi, so that means you have to go deeper into the tree if you're going to get those. So it does depend quite a bit on what your terrain looks like, what your resource situation looks like when you are planning to go for straight culture. So, I mean, there's a number of different ways you can run this depending on what you're going to do and your situation specifically in-game. But probably if you're playing Beyond the Sword, you want to get one of the cultural corporations, if at all possible, just because they're so strong in late game. I think it's maybe less valuable to try to pick up some of the late game cultural wonders, things like Eiffel Tower. Most of my culture games were in the vanilla base version of Civ 4.
I have a lot of background knowledge on this, actually. Somebody on post number 3, DWI and NGJA, I don't know how you pronounce that, he referenced Hazes and Skies, and I would say that that is the definitive Beyond the Sword culture guide. He, along with Lexad and a few others, Place and Time, are the Hall of Fame fastest culture time setters, and they have some ridiculous times. Like, I think Lexad has a game that beat 1000 AD for culture. Now, when you turn up your slider, it's dependent on how safe you think you are and how many religions you have. It comes down pretty much to that. In an optimized max finish game, you are going to hit liberalism first with as few great scientists as possible, and you're going to take nationalism. And right after that, you turn off your slider for science and turn up your culture slider. You're going to be relying on the 50% multipliers that come with music. For some of the culture multipliers, you'll put Hermitage in your best city or maybe your second best city, depending on how you're going to distribute the culture between your three legendary cities. And you're going to be using your great artists to balance out. You want your three cities to finish at the same time, basically. And so where you decide to put Hermitage is a function of how much you believe you can use those great artists to compensate and how much difference the culture output in each of the cities is. Democracy is not usually favored because when you play for culture, you're usually using one or two cottage cities that you developed from the early game, and the amount of time it takes to research democracy wouldn't make up for the lost turns of going there, the lost culture from running the slider during that time period, especially if you're running free speech culture at that point. So that's not usually good. Now, that's only if you've been planning to win culture from turn zero or from the opening turns. You know, maybe you settled on it at like turn 80 or 100 or something when you realize you have peaceful neighbors. Once you start getting past that point, you've committed to a more standard gameplay aspect. If you're getting to 180 or later and you haven't committed to culture yet, then you're probably going to have formed some more scientists than you would have wanted under an ideal culture game. And you're probably not as certain about your military security, your diplomacy. So now you're starting to look for technologies like rifles. You're starting to look to the culture corporations, possibly. The culture wonders, as Sula said, it's really not worth researching that deep with the techs that are that expensive just to get them. But they are more so if you decide late in the game that you want to go culture, you have a corporation available that gives you a culture benefit. And like sushi and like jewelers or something, you build those wonders too, and you might be able to beat a space time even very late in the game if you have enough religions as well. Otherwise, those wonders are actually more valuable for the resources they provide. Anytime you build one of those wonders, you can trade 5 of those resources away and 4 of them without losing the happiness bonus from having one of them. And that's very powerful late game. It meshes very well with late game corporations. You can trade like hit singles or iron and stuff like that. But that's not really relevant to a culture game. If you want a speed culture game, you're living nationalism with as many cathedrals as you can get and artist bombing to even out your cities.
All I have to add on this, it's well known a culture victory is not any kind of favorite or preference of mine. But on the specific point about moving culture slider to 100%, it's wonderful when you're playing a cooperative game with your fellow Civ players and you're getting near the end and you've taken the cities running down to when the last AI is destroyed, especially if you've been capturing some cities and another human player has been capturing some cities. When you're measuring who's going to quote-unquote win by score, putting your culture up as much as possible is a wonderful way to help with it.
Emphasize food in all cities. Farm over towns. Go, go, go.
Recorded for episode 132.
Next topic is still Civ 4, started by Randy Random. He really likes his randoms, much like me and Mafia. Anyway, the thread title is Post-Liberalism Great People. And it's assuming you have an academy, do you have a preferred great person that you will try to generate? Merchants and scientists seem to have the most slots available. He usually runs merchants in his great person farm and trade missions for 100% flyer. Okay. Well, when you're that far into the game, I wouldn't necessarily say that an academy is that great anyway. I mean, if you're talking post-lib, there's a good chance you're going to do something game-deciding before an academy would beat a scientist bulk, or even a golden age for that matter, so this is something I'd like to point out. It really depends on your goal. If I am looking for a fast war in the Renaissance, I might be looking to upgrade a bunch of maces or some other unit to rifles, or say, any knights or cuirassiers, cavalry, or maybe even horse archers, then you would be looking for merchants to get the goal to upgrade your units and attack quickly. It's not efficient, but it becomes more efficient as you capture a bunch of cities on the cheap. So if you're going for that, you might want to farm a merchant for the gold. It's okay, but not great to use a trade mission to bump the slider. And engineers are awesome if you can wait for mining ink. So if you're playing a longer game, that's probably the great person you want the most. I think sushi's a little overrated, not that it's terrible, but you have to go out of your way for it. Whereas mining ink is excellent. You need corporations for assembly line, and you need railroad to get into the deep tech, not to mention railroad itself is an excellent tech. And you get the fastest benefit from mining ink to top it off. It is hands down the best corporation by a mile. And so if you're going to go that late in the game, it probably wouldn't be a bad idea to farm an engineer or an engineer unless you're going to be running state property. So say you have a lot of overseas holdings or you're going to capture a lot of overseas holdings, then you might skip on the engineer. But if you're not, then definitely consider it for mining ink because the mining ink is really good. It's mostly going to be engineers or merchants. Scientists kind of lose their benefit from their bold value at that point, and the others just seem weak. Like, the late game profit is weak. The only thing you can really do with players that late in the game is a golden age, which is a fairly well-represented pull option. And late game, golden ages aren't bad, especially in Mausoleum, but even if you don't, certainly you can try to farm different great people just from a golden age as well. But I think the stock answer here is just going to depend on what you're doing and what you're trying to do in the next 20 to 50 turns. And that will dictate whether you're going to get engineer merchants or just try to get a different great person.
Yeah, I mean, if you get a great prophet that late in the game, the only religion that you could probably try would be, Islam, because before that most people will have, tried it already. Unless you were the one to get philosophy first on the way to liberalism, then I can see how it's possible for you to shrine Taoism. But that said, probably mostly, you're rooting for scientists and merchants. I'm used to the yield with that anyway, because, you build the science modifier building, presumably, if you've, gotten lived. I've also, done things where I've been running mostly artists, and that's only if I'm going for a cultural victory. I mean, in no other cases, really. The last game, I think I popped out, five great artists after liberalism because I just wanted to get the cultural victory faster. And it was good.
That's true. It's true. Your artists are definitely good for culture victory, and you'd want to farm as many as possible. That is, and you would get the master of liberalism, certainly. I completely forget about that. But they're a big part of culture wins, yes.
Yeah, I guess with a great profit, if you still haven't use a great person for a golden age yet, or are you thinking about a shrine? I mean, if you've got choose religions on, then probably the only, one of the last, if not the last religion that was founded may still in fact be needing of a shrine. And like Lisa said, you'd want it to be, your religion, but then you'd also want to take into account how many cities do you have already, how many cities do you think that you're probably going to have, how well is it spread, and is that, you know, are you looking for a shorter-term game or a longer-term game? Because if you're going to shrine it, I would think that that would be more advantageous if you're thinking of something going on a little longer as opposed to something shorter, because they're either the investment you need to continue to spread that religion or an extended period of time so that you're getting that kind of that incremental goal. Like there's an extra 10, 20, 30 gold a turn, which, you know, given your golden age, however many turns that may last, you know, run the slider down to zero. You know, how long are you going to have to get that same amount of gold from a golden age? So I would think that a golden age would
be the end of the game. I'm going to say it. After liberalism, a shrine is almost always terrible. Not just bad, but terrible. Unless you don't have, unless you can brand multiple golden ages for some reason, I don't know why you would do that so early. The problem with shrines is it takes so long to pay them back, and if you're going to have to spread missionaries, it gets even worse. I mean, you're not even going to break even on some of that sometimes if you're spamming the missionaries out, at least when it comes to a game-deciding point in the game. Not necessarily the end of the game, because you don't really care about extending your blowout lead at the end. What you care about is getting the position where you take a position strong enough to win the game for sure. And the ability to do that with a profit post-liberalism with anything but a golden age is really, really rare. I mean, maybe if you're playing on like a huge map, you just captured a holy city that has 80-plus cities in the religion, okay, fine, you would shrine that. But for the most part, you're going to see at most somewhere between 10 and 20 gold from a shrine. And you're going to see hundreds of gold from a golden age, and you're going to see that a lot sooner without a single investment in any missionaries at all. So that's a huge draw for the golden age. It's almost impossible to beat that with a shrine. It's, like I said, very rare situations that will probably be very obvious. Maybe you can consider it. But late game profits are pretty much golden age fodder.
I probably wouldn't do it unless if I were on my third golden age. Like I've never really, I think I can count like maybe one game in the hundreds I've played that I've gone for a third golden age. I think I've usually gone for two and tried to get, you know, Taj Mahal. And I mean, I've also tried to do, you know, getting the Taj Mahal, getting the Taj Mahal and getting like my golden age after I've gone Mausoleum. And which, you know, effectively doubles your golden age time, which is awesome. But, I mean, come on, like, have you ever gone for a third golden age with three?
Yeah,
you
know, I do it a fair bit on any game wins, like safe wins or things like that, I'll do it. But certainly, if you're deciding to game by the Renaissance era or early industrial, then you're probably not going to get enough great people to run a third golden age. But there are definitely times, especially with Mausoleum, where you consider it. But, you know, what else are you going to do with the profit? I guess you can then consider shrining versus settling. And believe it or not, that itself is not always an easy decision. Say you have a shrine in something like Islam or Taoism to cite the latest two technologies that found religion. And there's like, you know, three cities with the religion right now, and you shrine it. So you're going to be behind the 7 yield of the settled great prophet for quite a number of turns until you build missionaries. Then you also have to factor in the missionary cost. And usually hammers are a little bit more valuable than gold, but even if you just say gold is equal to a hammer, if you would just build wealth, you're still going to be behind all the hammers you sunk into that prophet that you could have just sunk into wealth and gone forward on the tech. It's still going to take a decent amount of time for a small amount of religious cities like that to be a settled great prophet. Certainly, if you have like 10 plus cities, the shrine starts to look better than a settled great prophet. But it's not a gimme, especially if you want the hammers and say an ironwork city or something to just go for a shrine like that.
And to add another factor into the power of the golden age, if you choose to get a golden age from a post-liberalism great person, and again, we're going to focus here on the great prophet. Then during that golden age, if you continue to run specialists to make sure you max out your specialists as well, if you're not doing that already, then that's just going to beget more great people. Because then you did plus
you can't take advantage of that by starving your city, because cities can only starve down one pop at a time. So what you would do is you'd run specialists so that you would gradually starve, and then right towards the end, when you start literally losing pop, literally take every person off of any tile and just mass run specialists and cast system, for example. Or if you have the slots, do it outside of cast system. And, yeah, you can basically starve down on one pop at a time to get massive amounts of great person points. And sometimes if you do this in multiple cities, farm out two or even three great people in a single golden age, it's very interesting. And you do take a small hit to your city's production, but if you want those great people, you know, having, say, 4,000 gold out of nowhere isn't necessarily a bad thing. So it's worth considering.
I think that one of the reasons why people are going for Great Merchants after liberalism is because of the corporations they can found. Oh, I mean, Great Engineers are great too, because they do found two corporations, if I remember correctly. One of which Phil mentioned earlier, Mining Inc., and the other one. Somebody help me out here.
Great Construction.
Oh yeah, Great Construction. Yeah, there is actually one. Corporation that a great artist can find, which is Civilized Jewelers. I mean, it's not the best corporation, but if you do end up with a great artist and you're not going for culture, then that might be one of the best things you can do with it.
Yeah, if you want to tank that far, I'll go in culture. Maybe you decide to go culture really light, you can consider that.
Yeah, that's a cultural possibility. Although, I mean, at that point, like, you want to really just be, reworking your artist.
Yeah, at that point, if you're going culture, you would just bomb it. Absolutely. It's interesting, though, that particular corporation always runs a profit, even in Branch City, is assuming you have the gold multipliers. So you can really get away with spamming the heck out of it. Now, is that worth the hammer? I don't know. That's a good question. I can't really think of too many situations where it's great, but if you've already run the golden ages and you're not going culture, heck, why not, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe we can close out this topic by dispelling any rumor that I, in fact, maybe a sound-alike of Dan Q and not actually Dan Q by ensuring to mention that, yes, there is a poll attached to this thread. And
Dan and Paul.
Recorded for episode 134.
Most common stuff beginners lacking at. The word stuff, but anyway.
It's in preposition of.
Lacking at, yeah, what is that?
I won't be the grammar.
The grammar police, what the hell, man?
You're an old engineer, someone has to do it, so I'm going to do it.
I actually had an interesting experience recently because I played with my dad on multiplayer to teach him how to play the game. And he was completely different. So I kind of got two perspectives. I remember how it was when I started playing, and really fresh is seeing my dad play. And one of the biggest problems he had, we were playing C4, was that he thought he could only do actions in the blue circles because the blue circles were being offered to him.
Oh, because so much stuff now has helper things.
Yeah. So I had to kind of break him down to like, you know, the land works and stuff. But I never had that problem when I was playing C4. My biggest problem, the thing that I lacked in the most was great people. And that, even today, remains something I really have to work at if I want to play at deity level. I really have to get that right. Or if I want to compete with Phil to get the highest score at the end of our Saturday multiplayer games, I actually have to pay attention to my great people production. But yes, I didn't have any of the really common beginner problems when I was playing Civ 4, possibly because I was already familiar enough with Civ. But I can kind of hit the stuff that is hidden and stupid, like the AI modifiers. That stuff hit me pretty early on and limited me to around the Prince level until I started meeting people from the forums and learning about all the tricks of the trade and the micro and all that kind of stuff. But from my dad's point of view, it was a matter of the game is telling him what can be done, and that's really limited.
One of the areas that the beginning players often have difficulty grasping is something that can be shared between Civilization 4 and Civilization 5, and that's city management. And the big thing is that not every building is not only going to be advantageous in every city, but can actually be a disadvantage to you, a disadvantage being instead of taking those turns in order to build that building, for example, you could have, in fact, been building a unit, for instance. That's something that's commonly shared between the two, and also actually also commonly shared between the two, is forgetting their science infrastructure. Spenison said in the thread, if you're not teching, you're not winning, and you're going to need that science infrastructure. And in Civilization V, you need a library at the very least.
There's actually a bigger issue with science in Civilization IV, and that is, if at any point during your play, your science slider has to drop because you don't have money, and then later you recover your economy, if you're a beginner player, you don't know what those percentage things up in the top left-hand corner mean, so your science will stay at 20% the rest of the game. You'll have lots of gold, though.
Yeah, well, okay. I guess the first thing for beginners is you need to learn just all the what everything in the game does. When you click on a button, what happens, what each of the symbols in the game means, yada, yada, yada. I that's true for any game. You just have to be able to look at the screen and know what's happening, at least, at the minimum. That's certainly a barrier to somebody who's never played a Civ game before. But I think for people who are actually trying to improve at the game, you know, once they're past the instruction manual stage, not that there's a good instruction manual, but you know what I'm getting at. Once they're past the stage where they can look at the screen and at least tell, like, okay, that symbol means gold. If I right-click, I can move. If I, you know, mousing over this farm icon and clicking, it means I'm going to irrigate the tile, because I equals farm, always.
The tutorial stage.
Yeah. You need to get past that. And from there, one of the hardest things for beginners in all the Civ games, at least to me, is they don't really have any goal focus, and they don't know it's possible. So they just kind of make choices haphazardly. Like, there's no strategy behind the choices. They don't even know how to go about formulating a strategy that's advantageous that would allow them to pick the good choices. And a lot of that, I think for every beginner, it would help a lot to, you know, either look through forum posts or maybe watch Majin's videos in the case of Civ 5. There are resources available to learning the game quickly if that's what you're interested in doing. But certainly just learning what's possible to do. You know, you can get the knights and the BCs, for example. If you don't know that, then you're going to have a hell of a time reaching that or ever learning that you can do that unless you find out in another way or you just experiment like crazy. So there's that aspect. And what else would really help a beginner? I guess the frame of mind that you do have finite resources and you have to invest them in a way that offers you the best return. And that sounds very business-like, I guess, but that's kind of how you look at it in Civ, too. You only have so many options, and one of them is going to get you to your goal more quickly for less cost than the other options. And that's probably the one you should be picking. And, you know, a lot of the learning experience in Civ is figuring out how to go about doing that so that you can consistently evaluate, you know, what your best option is in a given situation, whether it's deciding between the library and the unit, or if it's deciding between two different buildings, or if it's deciding which technology to research first. All that, you still have the same frame of mind when you're picking that technology, or you're picking that building, or you're picking that unit.
Well, yeah, so I think to go along with the fact that you need to recognize that, you know, you have finite resources, so nothing is infinite. Also, nothing is absolute. So even if you're looking at the different approaches and you decide, okay, I've looked at how I want to go about a cultural victory, for example, to realize that it's not an absolute. So in other words, this is an approach to a cultural victory, and this will absolutely help me or as a minor, or especially the extreme, this will absolutely get me to win. Your ability to be able to adapt, your ability to recognize that this is a template, and then to be able to put that into a particular circumstance, which I think comes from the, you've already informed yourself, that's great, and you could read lots of people's accounts, and you could watch lots of people's videos, which absolutely helps, by the way, but I think part about things not being absolute comes from experience.
There's no absolutes as an absolute?
No, because you don't absolutely have to recognize that there is no absolute, because even if you don't recognize that, it's not then to say that you're not going to win just by happenstance.
I'm pretty sure every time you get killed off, as in your last city gets captured, you lose. I'm pretty sure that's pretty consistent. So even the no absolute isn't really an absolute.
The thing on where you have to kill all the units, too.
Mm. Well, you can change that, though, with require complete kills versus not requiring complete kills.
In the experience, you wouldn't have to go to the absolute of having your last city taken, and if the complete kills were enabled, your last unit destroyed, to realize, I probably screwed this game. You get kind of a situation where either I know I'm not going to going to be able to come back, absolutely, or at the very least, it's not going to be reasonable to be able to come back. You have to decide for yourself, am I willing to invest so many turns on the risk that I could actually get myself back to the position I was in X number of turns ago, or just need to realize that this was a mistake and I either need to start over again, or if it's, especially if it's a single player game and you're saving as you go along, I should go back 20, 30 turns and try this approach instead. And you can even do that even if you are winning in your current circumstance. Maybe you think, maybe I could actually be doing even better than I am 30 turns later. Perhaps what a significant thing I accomplished from 30 turns ago, I could do 15 turns instead of 30, so then you go back and try to do even better.
Reporter for episode 136.
For this section, we're going to be discussing mounted units. There's a forum post about if mounted units are weak. My thinking about this, what the person is saying, there's two relationships between units to consider. There's mounted units to their counters, spearmen, pikemen, and there's mounted units to iron units. One of the problems with vanilla is that iron is a little bit too important. It's used for both foot soldiers and siege units. This is somewhat lessened to some extent once cannon come around because they don't require resources anymore. But that makes it very difficult to balance the horse units versus the iron units in the early game. And also, since spearmen and pikemen are the only spammable melee unit in the early game, it ends up that the AI builds tons and tons and tons of spearmen and pikemen, and so as a result, it's somewhat difficult to use things like knights and such.
Yeah, there seems to be a real downer when it comes to mounted units, and certainly for the reasons that Val has suggested, it shouldn't be the primary force of your army. And of course, we're emphasizing the single player aspect here, because yes, multiplayer is a whole another question. But to me, mounted units do have its advantages. Its ability to move after attack, well, assuming of course that the last movement isn't an attack, but anyway, that you can go in and you can take out melee units and then back off, or go in and take out archery and siege units even and back off, and then allow your melee units to move in, and sometimes even to be a bit sacrificial. In other words, try to position them so that perhaps the AI will go after those units, say with their spearmen or pikemen, attack. Yes, they may have been successful, but not only are they weaker, perhaps they're farther away from your melee units or some of your melee units, so then those melee units of yours can move in closer to a city and or now closer to the melee unit, again, the spearmen or the pikemen that just attack your units. Your unit has been successful, but it's been weakened. You're able to finish that off, and then you're able to concentrate on the city. It's kind of, you know, we've moved from the sack of doom to the carpet of doom. Help the mounted units clear the carpet, and then move on in with your melee, and then depending upon the timeline of the game, too, also with your archery support. It's all siege support. All your archers and your catapults.
Basically, the thing with mounted units is they're very situational. The attack and move sort of situation requires open terrain and no movement slowing abilities. And so what it results is you need to have an enemy that's not comprised entirely of spearmen. You need to have open terrain. You need to have the horse resources built and improved when most people will probably be going the iron track first. So it's very situational in the vanilla game. And it does have its advantages when that situation is available, obviously.
I think in the early game, with horsemen, it becomes a lot more of an advantage, especially like with four, you know, movement points, if you like. Use it to very quickly, you know, go on the warpath, you know, where you're not waiting so much for troops to arrive at a, you know, somewhat distant location.
Quickly, there are those cities are going to completely wall you, perhaps in the literal sense, but even without. I don't know. I think they over-nerfed them in the patch from their original value, but in their original value, they were really strong.
So I agree.
Maybe they should look at the city thing again, or, I don't know, maybe give them an extra flanking bonus, something that makes them a little bit more dominant in the field at the minimum, just because right now they are a little bit out of place in the game, in the department being too weak instead of the department being too strong. It's not easy to attain that, but even so,
I think they should look at mounted units again, just based on how players use them. It's, and unless it's a unique unit like the Kashyyyk or something, it's not really there. They never really shine. You have to like really work to use them.
And another limitation of mounted units, that also ties into the fact that Sala mentioned about wanting the terrain to be able to use them effectively, is their lack of being able to make use of a terrain's defensive bonus. So if you're already having difficulty moving around because of, oh, yes, it's really terrain, but that's okay, I'll just move it onto this hill. It's not providing any more defense to that. If the unit, if the mounted unit is on defense as compared to if it's in a grassland or plains, for example, which just adds to the good thing that it can move after attack, but it needs to be able to either move again so that either it's out of the way or you're okay with it dying. In other words, you're okay with it being sacrificial. You actually want to try to lure some units away from what you consider would should be, to me, most of the time, your main force of attack, and I'm focusing here on the early game with the siege and the melee units attacking a city, for example. If that's in fact what it is that you're going to do, if that's the end goal, or again, if your goal is to just actually, you know, get rid of the Carpet of Doom, sometimes siege units are also better still. So using them to attack a city, you know, if it's kind of a last blow sort of a thing, oh, I can move, you know, I can move that in there because it's got so much turns and then it can attack. But, I think the comment that you really have to work at making this being effective for you is important. That's not to say never to build them. They're, I don't know if it was to say cavalry is weak, but cavalry, and perhaps a better statement, cavalry is weak by itself, even more weak by itself than compared to, say, melee units being, quote-unquote, weaker by themselves.
I wouldn't even say they're necessarily weak or strong, just that they're very situational. They require us on a specific set of circumstances to be useful. Open terrain, no cities, no spearmen, etc.
I wish they had a little bit more speed after the early ones, too. And you look at something as 3-speed versus 2-speed and 5. I mean, the extra speed, the ability to move after attack is nice, but in the vast majority of situations, you're still exposing yourself a little bit much with your mounted, just because you only have 3-speed movements. So I'm thinking of an ice in particular. So later mounted, too, just feels slower.
Well, then, of course, there's also the 1-unit per tile issue, so the ability to move in and then move out is also limited. Oh, there's already another mounted unit there, or a melee unit there, or a siege unit there. Oh.
I would like to see mounted be at least double the movement of your standard infantry units, because then not only would you have some usage in the attacking and returning to your tile, but you could also manipulate 1 unit per tile, and then you could even argue that their weakness is better compensated by the fact that you can place them more readily. For example, you could run and hit a city, run it out, and not eat a lot of retaliation. So as long as you didn't die on the physical process of attacking the city, which can happen if you're behind, but otherwise it usually won't, then you would have a viable method of using mounted units.
Later in the game, one thing that can offset that is that there's more roads built, so that speeds up mounted units, and there's also the mobility promotion that they can get, which raises them back up to 4 movement. I think that really the main thing is just that, I mean, sure, you can get to your target quickly, but if your target is all pikemen, how are you going to do anything? Because that's the only spammable melee unit. So the AI likes building lots of pikemen.
Yeah, then you're going to want a situation where, yeah, just going, if you're facing that, and let's say that your only option is, you know, pikemen in response as well, or maybe even, you know, talking about mounted units, then that can be effective. I mean, first off, if you're talking about like a generational difference, like if you've got knights and they still have spearmen, I mean, it's still going to be an issue, but not as great an issue. But you should come in with some archery units. So let's say you don't even have any iron, so forget about the catapults. Okay, you come in with archers, you soften those spearmen, you soften those pikemen, and then a mounted unit could go in, perhaps, and finish it off, and then retreat. But still, again, it's really having to think about this.
These are the various problems with mounted units. There are some relatively straightforward solutions that could be pursued. For example, pikemen and spearmen are currently hard counters. They have a 100% bonus against mounted units, and aren't quite as useful against anything else. They die very quickly to longswords and such. And if that's shifted more towards a soft counter situation, where instead of a 100% bonus, if it has a 50% bonus against mounted, and then say a 25% bonus on defense, then that's a little bit more flexible. And the AI can also deal with that better, because if you're building no mounted, and they're building lots of pikemen, they're obviously in a bad situation. Whereas if the pikemen are somewhat good at defending against other units too, it helps the AI out, and also makes mounted units more viable overall.
I don't like that, though, because it pulls the need for strategic resource units. You can really span out the pikemen, and now that they're more durable, they'll perform much better. Then you have issues like the German unique unit as well. That would get kind of silly, but you know, that could be worked on individually since it's a one-tip thing. I think mounted would benefit a lot more from getting their flanking bonuses back. I mean, you look at it from a realism sense, which I hate doing, but that was when mounted units were at their best in history, is when they were actually flanking people. And in a hex-based game with one unit per tile, nothing screams with that kind of tactic like cavalry. Like, I don't see why they don't get more heavy special flanking bonuses for surrounding a unit.
Yeah. There's a combination of factors. I agree that the flanking bonus is too low, and it doesn't really make sense, because the AI usually has more units, so they usually can get a better advantage out of the flanking bonus, and they use it well, too. The AI will move units in to flank, so they try and take advantage of it, but there's not really much of a bonus there.
There used to be, though. You know, like, in release, when you had, before all the massive nerfs, I literally had situations where I had just a couple promotions on a horseman, would surround the pike and one-shot it. Like, you know, it's super effective, 10-hit point, done, with one attack. Just using a horseman against a pike, like, I have a previous era unit curb-stomping. Now, that's probably a little bit extreme, if you can do things like that. But it shows that if you had the right kind of multipliers on the mounted units, they could still be very effective, and still not completely destroy their balance against other units. I don't know. And it's still something that you could build against as well if you gave it some thought. But it may be a legitimate threat on the battlefield as opposed to, it's a cavalry. It's all good. It's not a long sword or something, you know. Or I guess that would be knight and long sword. You get my point.
One way to avoid the extreme situations like that is to do several small changes to the game. So, like, for example, making pikemen a bit less important, adding a little bit more of a flanking bonus, balancing out the ratio of iron to horses, and, you know, a number of small factors that, when combined, can help balance the game effectively and avoid any exploitive situations.
And we should give some credit where credit is due in this thread. This thread started by Bam Buka, which is too bad he didn't start it before Halloween, because then I could have made a boop joke, but now I can't. Not really. That's a shame.
For
this opportunity, I must say.
Yeah. And there's also, when they had the big round of nerfs, they did a lot of things to mounted units. They reduced the strength, they increased the cost, they reduced the damage against cities, and mounted units can't get the siege promotion anyway. So they already have a disadvantage against cities. And it's just this combination of factors that they all did together, which took mounted units from clearly overpowered it. Release when people could just build, you know, six companion cavalry and win the game, to a situation where it's very situational.
Yeah, I think I remember a certain, like four or five horsemen army, I believe that was on a Let's Play by somebody on this call, I don't know.
that was disgusting. Was that Emperor or Mortal? I just wiped the con, it was like four or five AI, and it was four horsemen, it was really disgusting.
I think, I'm sure you said it was Immortal.
Alright.
Recorded for episode 135. We have a question from Carbon Taxes on the Civ 5 forums here, inquiring why, maybe he says it's just his own noobness, but some luxuries suck so hard. So he says gold and silver, you get the mints for your extra money,
might not be huge, but it's at least something. Ivory, you get Circus for the happiness, and he said, thanks to your own reserve not being maintenance for it, which is an extra boost. Spice, incense, and wine, you get the monastery for a lot of extra culture. And then he says, pearls, gems, cotton, whales, furs, all seem to be absolutely horrible because there's no building options for them, they're slow to come up, you gotta go around and get protects for them and all those other things. And so he's just asking, you know, is he missing something about these other luxuries, or is it really disproportionate out there?
Just thinking of it in the terms of what else can I get other than the fact that they make the Civ happy. This making your civilization happy may be far more important than getting these extra little bits. Now, you have to think of those extra little bits as bonuses, not your main reason for getting the luxury resource.
Exactly.
I disagree with that.
Some more than others. So, yeah, I wouldn't say they are important bonuses, but they're already a pretty good deal to get the plus five happy.
Taking out of context, though, say that you get only resources that have no bonus, and your opponent gets resources that have the bonuses, and you just get this off of random spawns. Assuming you would otherwise be equal, you are at a big disadvantage just because the game gave you crummier happiness resources. Now, I know Firaxis fails to balance in spawns anyway, and that you might simply get no luxury resources, so anything's better than nothing. But yeah, these are definitely not. You really don't look at this and see balance. When you have the option to get extra culture early, or extra happiness in particular early, as opposed to, well, nothing at all. And I don't think the game has an algorithm for balancing your options in terms of buildings between spawn locations on the map. If it does, there's certainly no anecdotal evidence of that. I mean, I've gotten starts where you have no options for building beyond your basic, just improve the tile. And again, luxuries are nice, but if you're comparing two positions and one person has these bonuses, but not just little bonuses, and you get like two circuses, three circuses, you can basically afford an extra city and happiness. Or, you know, you get a couple monasteries going, and all of a sudden, somebody's like a social policy two ahead. That's pretty asinine, considering that they did the exact same thing that you did for the most part.
Yeah, so for the circus, speaking of luxury resources, specifically with ivory plus two happiness and no maintenance, and then for the monastery with incense and wine, getting plus two culture from each one of those resources nearby. I think Remark Nalvito in the thread, past guest on the show, says your basic thesis, referring to carbon taxes, that your basic thesis that some luxuries are greater than others is accurate, but the specifics are a bit off. And I think part of that's going to depend on what it is that you think you need and what it is that you actually need. We've talked about happiness, which, of course, if you get too much on happiness, you get to 10 on happiness, and you've got the combat ability. But even if you're at 1 on happiness, you've got growth slowing down. Now, perhaps this is something that isn't in and of itself bad. As you've grown as much as you want to, and until you get some other happiness infrastructure in place or whatever, you're fine with it. You're not expanding too much. I think when you get into those extra luxuries, they are inferior when often when you don't have somebody to trade them to, because they're not doing anything for you other than being a backup in case one of the other ones ends up getting pillaged. Talk about ivory, talk about the incense and wine, because there is a building, city building that you can build that can then happiness on top of, or increase on top of the happiness that you're getting from the. Anyway, if you're looking at the base value in terms of what you're getting, in addition to the happy, gems is going to give you plus 3 gold, and then, of course, there's also the ability to mine it on top of that. Like, the poster talks about, you know, like, kind of going hey, on gold and silver and ivory and spine and spice, incense, and wine. And looking at all of the particular resources, I think it really depends on, do you have more than one? And if you have more than one, do you have somebody to trade it to? And if you have as many as you can, even just one source of it, that's plus 4 happy for your empire. So you can decide, you know, do I need these luxuries for the happiness, or do I have building this happiness infrastructure that then means that I can turn around and sell it? Now, I often look at luxuries, particularly as early on in the game, in terms of who can I sell it to? but my empire is small, and I'm not as concerned about happiness, but as the game goes on, I'm looking for as a diverse collection of resources as possible, hopefully in my control, or trading for it typically for a surplus resource in order to maintain a surplus happy, which allows my cities to continue to grow, to allow me to continue to settle new cities or capture cities or what's their puppets, annex cities.
It's true, but this point still stands. Like, when you have a building set in a city to take advantage of multiple resources in the area, and sometimes it would require multiple resources to make the building worthwhile to attain anytime soon. You get that benefit conferred regardless of whether you trade the resource, if I'm not mistaken. So it's still a bonus above and beyond the trade value and the happiness value of the base luxury. But yeah, as Martin Alito pointed out, gems aren't as bad as they need to sound here because they actually have a better tile yield. Although he does comment that cotton and furs are pretty bad. Suggests settling on cotton, which is interesting, and it certainly sounds like it would be worth it to get the happiness right away.
Whales and pearls are particularly rare enough that if you're able to get multiple ones or even just one and you're looking for a cash infusion, so long as you've got a neighbor nearby, you're probably going to have someone that would be willing to buy it, although you do have to kind of trade that off with, well, how good are my relations with that civilization, because they might be willing to give me, you know, somewhere between 150 and 200 gold for it, or if you really tick them off, if they'll take anything for it, it might even be half that. Then you still have to decide in there. But I think the luxuries that are going to be inferior to you are really, generally speaking, situation dependent, as with almost anything. But I will agree that, yeah, fur and even cotton are some of the quote unquote more generally weaker ones. Maybe silver, too, just because of where you often find silver is not the best.
The tundra. That's the other problem with fur. It's always in the tundra. I don't want to settle a city down there just for that.
I guess I'm coming strongly. Like, I don't see this as a huge deficit. Like, a simple advantage and unique unit could probably overcome this. But it is, just slightly imbalanced. And I guess that's going a little bit too far to complain about it too much in a game where your top tier versus middle tier cities are quite a wide gap, so I don't know. I guess it's not that big of a deal in the end. If there's something to be addressed, this is going to be one of the last things you'd look at, I think.
Well, we can see what's the topic.
Any luxury is a good luxury, but definitely some do have that early kick in your favor.
Yeah, I'd say generally speaking, the ones that are really going to give you an advantage either through happiness or trade or buildings would be gems, ivory, incense, wine, pearls, and whales.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows, Podcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Why are you mad? Why are you hating, bro? Because now we've come to the end of the show.
Hate is gonna hate.
Dan's gonna pun.
All those other Civilization podcasts are just jealous.
Yeah, they've nothing.
All those other.
Nothing. Literally nothing. It's almost like they don't exist. I'll feel bad now there really is another one that's, not in the podcast family. Maybe a little, no. Oh, yeah.
We'll feel a drop of guilt, but that's not it.
I don't know.
If I knew somebody, I take a brief moment of silence and enjoyment and, to remember the dead and then move on. It's important, though, to make that moment.
Data sorted in 2011. Civilization 4, 5, and World Soundfest copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.